Iran defends its measures in response to the IAEA recent resolution, saying that the obstacle to the JCPOA revival talks is Washington's refusal to fulfill its obligations. The British economy declines for a second month in a row, heightening fears that the country is heading for a recession. And a U.S. House committee investigating the Capitol attack says there is enough evidence to indict former President Donald Trump for trying to overturn the results of the 2020 vote. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Iran has defended the measures it took in response to the recent resolution against its nuclear program by the Board of Governors of the IAEA.
Definitely, we couldn't let the political and non-technical measure of the agency go unanswered. Our actions have been decisive and proportionate. What Iran is doing now falls strictly under its nuclear safeguards obligations. What Iran has stopped doing is its voluntary measures. It is unfortunate if the IAEA's Director General would not know this or intentionally pose Iran's measures differently. Iran is entitled to end the commitments it undertook as a goodwill gesture when the other party violates a formerly agreed obligation. Therefore, Iran's measures create no proliferation worries.
The spokesman also said that the IAEA's resolution is driven by Israel and backed by its Western allies. He added the agency's director general has failed his duty to remain impartial and has been making comments against Iran beyond his technical capacity. He also dismissed the director general's comments that Iran's measures impede an agreement in the Vienna talks. He said that the obstacle to the talks remains the U.S.'s refusal to fulfill its obligations under the agreement. The British economy shrank for the second month in a row in April and the first back-to-back fall since COVID-19 hit. The contraction has increased the risk of the country slipping into recession. A short while ago, I've discussed that issue in our news review program with our guests. Let's see what they had to say. The British economy has suffered its first back-to-back slump since the COVID outbreak, heightening fears that the country is heading for a recession. According to the Office for National Statistics, the gross domestic product fell by a bigger than expected 0.3% in April. The economy also registered a drop of 0.1% in March. Output in the services, production, and construction sectors fell. That's the first time all main sectors have shrunk in over a year. Prices are rising at the fastest rate in 30 years, driven by record high fuel and energy costs. The Bank of England has warned the UK is facing a sharp economic slowdown and inflation of over 10% by the end of the year. I'm going to let me invite a couple of guests and shed some further light on this and get some insight. So our own Saeed Pourreza joining me from London. And Fry Hughes, journalist and author and activist from Belfast. Now, Saeed, you live there. Tell us how serious this is and how do people feel about this?
Well, this is significant, Beirut, and how people feel about it is born really by these figures. As you say, this is a decline that has been seen in the services, the construction and production sectors. It's unusual, something you would see at a time, for example, of a national lockdown, 0.3% decline at a time when it was a 0.1% growth had been expected. And it comes after a 0.1% decline of only a month earlier in March. What this basically means that there's less money going around, people are spending less, and businesses are investing less, and that potentially means fewer jobs. And looking at the cause of this, for example, there are domestic reasons, factors, and there are global factors. Domestically, you're looking at the ongoing Brexit saga, the disruptions that have been caused to the supply chain since Brexit happened. The cost of living crisis that people are grappling with, which has led to people spending less, particularly after the raising of the cap on energy prices. You looked at a more than 50% increase in energy prices for households, as well as fuel prices. For example, to fill the tank of an average family car right now, you will have to spend £100, a new record set only last week. So people are spending less and businesses are investing less because there is uncertainty about the future. And there are global factors too. The post-pandemic global commodity prices that have gone up are a contributing factor to this, exacerbated.
Okay, now let me ask Fra Hughes. Many people are blaming the Johnson government for most of these problems. And also, Fra, you also kind of mentioned maybe his support for the sanctions on Russia over Ukraine. So in your opinion, how far would you blame the Johnson administration for this situation?
Well, absolutely. Anthony alluded that it's a political choice. It's nothing to do with a word recession caused by financial kind of misregulations by the banks that we had in 2007, 2008, 2009. This is a political choice by first world countries, by the whole of Western Europe and the NATO-aligned American countries. You know, it's very much self-inflicted. But the problem is, I think no matter what the people do, even if people come out onto the streets, demand a change in the political direction of the government, that won't happen. We all know what needs to happen is the sanctions need to be lifted. Ukraine and Russia must come to a ceasefire and an agreed way forward about the future and neutrality of Ukraine, and allow the world really to recover from the COVID pandemic, which we're really just beginning to emerge from. But the reality of what should be done, what must be done, and what will be done are completely separate, because the people who run the government, many of them are millionaires, they care nothing for ordinary people, and they care nothing for the troubles that people will find themselves in, the difficulties that people will find themselves in. So what should be done and what will be done, there is a huge gulf between those two things, and I fear very much that the war in Ukraine, which is being, it's a proxy war through Ukraine by America upon Russia, it's going to end anytime soon. It's not going to end well, and I think we are really just entering a phase of geopolitical instability within Europe that's going to have huge global ramifications when it comes to famine, food shortages, food prices, energy prices. I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg, and I think we're in for a very long, hard, difficult road.
Okay. Thank you so much for the insight and input, Said Pourreza in London, Fra Hughes in Belfast. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Russia saying it's destroyed a large cache of weapons and military hardware, including some delivered by the U.S. and Europe to Ukraine in the eastern Donetsk region.
High-precision air-launched missiles destroyed in the area of Yudeshny railway station in the Donetsk People's Republic, a large number of weapons and military equipment delivered for Ukrainian nationalist groups, including from the United States and European countries.
The Russian official says a temporary deployment point for four mercenaries was also destroyed in the Lugansk region. Two batteries of multiple launch rocket systems in Lugansk and Kharkiv were hit as well. Russian and Ukrainian forces remain locked in a fierce battle in Severodonetsk. Kiev says its forces have been pushed back from the center of the city. Local Ukrainian authorities say the city's Azot chemical plant, where hundreds of people have taken shelter, is under heavy shelling. They say that Russian forces have destroyed a bridge connecting Severodonetsk to the city of Lysychansk, another battleground still under Ukrainian control in Lugansk. They say that three civilians have been killed in that city. John Emeter is following the Russia-Ukraine war, which has now concentrated in Ukraine's eastern region. Just an hour ago, he gave me an update on the situation there and how the international community is responding to it.
It looked like they'd taken Severodonetsk, but the battle for Donbass looks like it'll continue to be long. and hard. Russia is being accused of war crimes in Kharkiv at the moment, and the Ukrainian army has just been shelling where I am now, the center of town. I just went outside to find my neighbors sheltering in the corridor. So the war continues very much here. There is some calls, increasing signs that some people, some countries, at least behind the scenes, are calling for peaceful negotiation. Indeed, the NATO head, Jens Stoltenberg, talked yesterday suggesting that this war will have to go to a negotiating table at some point. But at the moment, that does still seem a long way off. And it looks like one side or the other is going to have to make a major breakthrough on the front lines for any side to start thinking about negotiations.
U.S. lawmakers are pushing for new legal proceedings against former President Donald Trump, and that over to January 6, 2020, unrest that saw his supporters storm Congress. A select committee probing the incident says it's gathered enough evidence that warrants criminal indictment of Trump for trying to overturn the results of the election. Congressional hearings are also scheduled that the investigators say shed light on Trump's attempts to spread false claims that the vote was rigged. The panel began its work last week. It's now calling on the Justice Department to indict the former president. And that's unprecedented. No U.S. president or ex-president has ever been indicted. Trump supporters attacked the Capitol building when Congress was certifying Biden's victory. The attack left several people dead. Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula, Seoul saying that the North has fired a series of suspected artillery shots over the weekend. The shots were a traditional type with relatively low altitude and short range. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff has stressed that Seoul maintains a firm military readiness in collaboration with the United States. The latest development came days after leader Kim Jong-un promised to use power for power to defend his country's sovereignty. North Korea has performed a blitz of sanctions-defying weapons tests this year. Those include firing an intercontinental ballistic missile at full range for the first time since 2017. While the U.S. is entangled in the Ukraine conflict, it's also pursuing another confrontational approach on the other side of the world. That's with China. The United States has been accused by Beijing of creating instability in China's backyard, an accusation that the U.S. has leveled against China, both military in nature.
China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand. And his speech was also, of course, very sharp. In terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both of these people laid out their positions on this, but the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war.
The latest round of altercation between the two countries comes as they held their first face-to-face talks on the sidelines of a summit in Singapore on Friday. During the event, however, China stated that besides military provocations like how Biden has said it would defend Taiwan militarily, Washington is trying to, quote, hijack countries in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, that came in reference to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which the U.S. announced in May, and involves 13 countries, excluding China.
The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative. Washington has made no secret about its stance on China, but the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure both militarily and economically.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. If you travel to different Muslim countries, you will notice that their people have a high opinion of your beliefs, motives, and aspirations, regardless of their governments. They admire our slogans against oppression, the snake-like Zionist network and hegemony. They admire the chants that we have shouted in support of the oppressed and the Palestinian nation. This is what Muslim nations think. Their behavior is indicative of the spread of an Islamic revolution. As you can see, even our nation's views regarding nuclear energy, the fact that the Iranian nation resisted the pressure of the enemies and asked for its right have been reflected in the Islamic world in a way that resulted in Muslim and Arab countries declaring the nuclear energy has turned into a public sense of urgency for all Arab countries. Both the friends and foes of the Iranian nation admit that the prophecy of Imam Khomeini rahmatullahi alayhi regarding the spread of the revolution has been realized today, an instance of which is the Palestinian issue. Like the Iranian nation, all nations are sympathetic towards the Palestinian nation.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Like the Iranian nation, all nations consider the Israeli regime as an illegitimate and imposed power on the region. Of course, many governments are not supportive of their nations. That idleness is exactly the element that strengthens Israel. The Zionist regime has no internal power to stand on its own feet. Today, there are two factors that have helped the Zionist regime to resist. One is the unconditional and shameless support of the U.S. for this degenerate regime, and the other is the lack of support for the Palestinian people on the part of the Arab and Muslim governments. Unfortunately, most of the Muslim governments do not carry out the responsibilities in favor of Palestine as they should, and they are not harmonious with their people. The third prominent point, which is important to our nation and youth, in Imam Khomeini's testament and in the statements that he made during the last 10 years of his blessed life, is that the Islamic Revolution helps our nation progress.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece,
Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Syed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside, and they can maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and, their workers and so on, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020. But they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss the Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Karish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. They're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Karish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory, but this time, the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted with the support of Israel to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, said Israel expected the IAEA's board of governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the US and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty. And it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the US and its allies, France, Britain and Germany, for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The US, however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution, because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over two dozen surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing two new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq
on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's in effect another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that establish beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine,
they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Imam Khomeini's viewpoint about the Prophet of Allah, Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny. All of us must be martyrs in the cause of Islam. Islam is the dearest of all things. I am so consider two points. First of all, unity of expression. That is, you should all be besides each other. And the second, for the sake of Allah. That is, our movement and uprising should be for God's satisfaction. The Almighty Allah has ordered Prophet Muhammad to tell the people that he has just one advice for the people, just one advice, and that is rising up for the sake of Allah. I preach only one thing to you, that you stand up in pairs or singly for Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that do not neglect association with the Holy Quran, this divine scripture and book of guidance, because whatever the Muslims have and will have throughout history is due to the bountiful grace of this sacred book. In this part of his speech, obviously, Imam Khomeini is talking about the importance of the Quran and the achievements that the Muslim Ummah or the Muslim world had. As it is said in the Quran, that has a bayanun linnas wa hudan wa maw'idatan. This is a clear statement and guidance and admonition, where this Quran is the guidance, this Quran is the admonition, this is a clear statement for the whole mankind. Therefore, the things that are being achieved by the Muslim Ummah, the bounties and the grace that the Muslim Ummah had, it is because of this sacred book, it is because of this Quran, and we must follow it and we must not neglect the association with the Holy Quran. When we look at the problems that we are facing in today's world, it is all because we have neglected the Quran. It is all because we are not following the path of the Quran. And especially in the West, if we have Islamophobia, if we have the wrong ideas about the Muslim Ummah or the Muslim world, it is only because that the Muslims have left and neglected their association with the Holy Quran. But if they could have this Quran, if they could hold it firmly and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, they would never be deviated. And Islam is the best religion in the world. Islam is the best way of guidance. It is the best way in order to get the perfection. But the condition is that we must follow the teachings of Holy Quran. And we must not neglect the Quran. On the other hand, we have the narrations where the Prophet has said that on the Day of Judgment, Quran will come and it will say that this nation, the Ummah of the Prophet, has neglected the Quran. Therefore, we must keep ourselves safe from neglecting the Quran and have the association and being in touch with the Quran by at least reading the translation of Quran, by at least attending some of the lectures which are delivered on the tafsir and exegesis of the Quran so that we can understand the teachings of Quran, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that's been affecting the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the emergence of India as a key player in the global pharmaceutical market, ready to cut its dependence on China. And we shall also take a look at how the war in Ukraine has exposed the duplicity of Western countries who have conveniently turned their focus away from Afghanistan.
The world's third largest manufacturer of medicine by volume, India, is taking giant strides in the global pharmaceutical industry. The country today exports medicine to more than 200 countries and supplies 20% of the global demand for generic drugs. It has prompted Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government in New Delhi to vigorously promote the country as the pharmacy of the world. However, experts believe issues like quality control and innovation hold the key for India to become the one-stop destination for medicine.
India's pharmaceutical market was estimated at $42 billion in 2021 and is projected to expand to $120 billion by 2030. The country's rise as the global pharma hub didn't happen overnight. Between 1972 and 2005, the absence of product patents in pharmaceuticals, together with restrictions on foreign investments in the 1970s and 1980s, paved the way for the development of a robust pharmaceutical manufacturing industry in India.
Because today we are supplying to almost 170 countries, more than 1.5 billion doses every year for the last 3 years. And almost about 60-65% requirement of the global vaccines are being catered by Serum Institute.
With a large network of 3,000 pharma companies and more than 10,000 manufacturing units across the country, India today is ranked third in the world in terms of production of medicine by volume and 14th in terms of value. The country is also the world's largest manufacturer of generic drugs and supplies. Over 50% of vaccines to the world, about 1 in 3 pills consumed in the US and 1 in 4 in the UK come from India. It is also the top supplier of medicine to developing countries in the global south. During the coronavirus pandemic, India exported life-saving medicine and vaccines to over 150 countries, establishing its reputation as the future pharmacy capital of the world. But experts caution that the pharma industry in India needs to build its capacities and focus on issues such as quality control and supply chains to achieve its vision of $120 billion growth by 2030.
The world's biggest pharmaceutical firms, known as Big Pharma, belong to the US and Europe. These companies, which include giants such as Pfizer, Roche, Novartis, Merck and GlaxoSmithKline, bank heavily on global supply chains. That's where countries like China and India play a key role. India's pharma industry also relies on China for raw materials. Amid growing strains in their relations, New Delhi has been looking to cut its dependence on Beijing to become self-sufficient and be known as, quote, pharmacy of the world.
India's pharmaceutical market is poised to grow at a compound annual growth rate of 37% between 2020 and 2025. And is expected to touch the figure of $50 billion, according to industry observers. The Indian government has tied the country's vision of Atmanirbhar Bharat, which translates into self-reliant India, to the self-sufficient pharmaceutical sector. To reduce its overwhelming dependence on China, the pharma sector needs to innovate and develop capacities to offer high-quality products at competitive rates.
Promotion of herbal cultivation. There is a National Medicinal Plants Board